Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, AI and creativity. Depending on who you talk to, artificial intelligence is either the end for humankind or the solution to our most complex problems. Either way, understanding what AI is and how it's being used is essential. Today, our focus is specifically about AI in the creative community. How is it being used? Should it be used? And what are the ethical implications? These questions and more were tackled in the Cultural Center of Cape Cod's recent exhibition, Autonomous. Joining us to talk about the role of AI in the creative process is Molly DeMoulinaire. She's Executive Director of the Cultural Center of Cape Cod. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having us.
Sure. John Stringfellow is an artist and one of the jurors for the Autonomous exhibit. Hi, John.
How are you?
Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So, Molly, why did you want to present a show about the intersection of art and AI?
Well, it happened because of a conversation with John and I, but I am always fascinated between the intersection of art and science. And I think that's really where a lot of creativity happens. And coming from a science center, I love the idea of getting people to be curious about the world around them and how things work. And I think curiosity is so important as we move through life. And I think as we learn new things about AI, whether it be in art or in all the different ways that we use it, efficiencies, I think it's about a conversation. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be scared of things. You just have to be curious and wonder a little bit about them. And then maybe you'll learn something and something incredible could come out of it.
You know, AI, I mean, for a lot of people, it seems so scary. Like AI, you know, you think of like HAL in 2001, you know, and
right.
All the scary stuff. But we use it in our day-to-day lives all the time now. We just don't even think about it as artificial intelligence, right? So, I mean...
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, people are scared of things they don't understand, right? And so having a scientific literacy is really important in our world, not necessarily everybody's forte. But if you don't understand something, there's this worry like, okay, is it going to replace something? Is it going to take over something? Is it going to create harm? Yeah. We immediately kind of go to that protective side, right? That fight or flight. It's like, okay, well, we've got to protect ourselves from that. And so I definitely think that that's a lot of times people's first reactions to it.
So what was the response from the art community when you put out the call for work and what kind of parameters, if any, did you put on how artists could use AI for the purposes of the show?
So there was definitely a mixed message from people. Some people really wanted to embrace artificial intelligence as a tool. And that's how a lot of artists are utilizing it that you'll see in the exhibition. And then there were definitely some artists who are like, nope, why are you doing this? You're the Cultural Center of Cape Cod. You're supposed to be supporting artists. Why are you killing art? Mm-hmm. And we didn't put any parameters on how they were allowed to utilize artificial intelligence in their work. Mm-hmm. We gave them full bandwidth to use it any way that they chose. But what we ask them to do is really tell us about that process, because I think as we're doing bringing these new ideas to people, it's important to have dialogue around that. And so having the artist take us through how they utilize the process, right down to the prompts, right down to the different steps that they used after the prompts, it was really an important part of what we were trying to get people to tell the whole story.
Yeah. All right, John, when did you first start considering the use of AI in your work, and what went through your mind when you heard about this?
Well, first of all, I want to respond to something that Molly said. A lot of people are afraid of things that they don't understand. Mm-hmm. As a creative person, I have always embraced what I don't understand, and I'm entranced by it, and I jump right in. When new software comes out, I jump in and I start pushing buttons to see how it all works. That's how I got started with AI. It was about a year ago. It's been April, so a few months more than a year. I discovered a program called Midjourney, and I immediately went and I started playing with it. And the first few things that I did were absolutely hideous. They were just, I said, my first prompt, I think, was Marilyn Monroe and Joan Rivers paddling down the River Seine in Paris with the Eiffel Tower in the back. And it created the most ugly, stupid image you would ever want to see. And there were sort of these collage faces on two women with malformed, deformed paddles going down the river in an impressionist painting. And it was really badly done. But staying with the program for over a year, I saw the capabilities of the program dramatically improve. And from every generation that they would make, it would improve by leaps and bounds. And fast forward to like a year later, it was creating things that I could not believe. And to me, the reason that I loved it is that I felt like I was working with all the power of every artist that ever existed, from the Lascaux Caves through the Impressionists, the Romanticists. They were all there with me. And to me, it wasn't a tool that I shouldn't use. I didn't feel like I was stealing. I felt like I was embracing a tool like no artist had ever had, and every artist I thought should embrace.
Mm. Yeah, not every artist feels that way, though.
Oh,
right?
Hell no.
Yeah.
Sorry.
All right, so Molly, how do you define AI, especially for the purposes of this show and using, you know, in art?
So the way we talk about AI in this particular show is you have some artists that have used it as simply an ideation tool. We had this gentleman working in the exhibition, and he's writing and creating a graphic novel about the immigration of his family to the South in the 1800s. And so he's utilizing it to create imagery that would be appropriate for that time and that environment and that culture. And then he's taking those ideas and doing original watercolors and original sketches. And that's what's really great is we had the AI images first so that people could see what the computer was saying this environment would look like. And then we actually had his sketchbooks with the original watercolors, because I think what people's first argument is it's not real art.
Right.
That paintbrush didn't touch the paper, so therefore it's not art. Right. And so it was really important for us as we were displaying the work to show you have a digital image that's created, and then you have an artist that is actually creating original work. And so it's very simple. If you're out in our beautiful landscape on the Cape, right, mm-hmm. you're always inspired by the environment. You see people painting marshes and sunsets and all the different environments on Cape Cod. That's an inspiration point. And yeah. So most of the artists in the exhibition utilize the tool as an inspiration point, yeah. not as an endpoint.
Yeah. You're saying something really interesting, too. It's like if you ask that question, what is art? So subjective,
right?
Absolutely. So, you know, what's inspirational is, again, very subjective depending on. But let's talk about some of the work presented in the Autonomous show. And listeners, you can see images from Autonomous, the show, at our website, capeendislands.org/thepoint, and you'll see some of this. And this is the one that jumped out at me the most, Molly. This was Donna Mahan's piece titled "Eye on You Three." Tell us about it. It's so cool.
Yes. So Donna is a textile artist and a painter, and so a fiber artist. And she is interested and intrigued by eyes and optic nerves. And so she was using AI to show her what the back of an eye or the retinal area of the eye would look like. And then she took this image that the computer gave her, and it's really beautiful. It's a lot of different colors, and there's also a black and white one, which I think is on your website, which she talked about creating that retinal nerve in a spirograph style. Mm-hmm. We remember the spirographs when we were kids, right?
Yeah.
And so now you have this really interesting but quite simplistic spirograph type picture of an eyeball, but then she's taken that and she's done the individual stitching. So she's created a piece of fiber art inspired by what the eye looks like, which is magical. I mean, when you think of our human bodies, and you know, people don't get to see that unless you're a scientist most of the time, you know, and or you remember anatomy class in high school.
So you were one of the judges, John.
Yes.
And looking at all this, I mean, this must have been, I mean, it's amazing some of this that was created, but wow.
It's amazing the different ways that, as Molly was saying, that the artists use it in their process. I myself would take the pieces and put in a prompt. And some people say that there is no art to the writing of a prompt. There's even some people that call themselves prompt engineers. But if you play with it enough, and you work with the robot, you will see that there is an art to it, and you have to train the robot to produce something that you want. There was an idea of Hercules and Samson that I was working with, and it took me months and months to finally craft what I wanted to come out of there. Mm-hmm. Whereas my partner, my life partner, Val Rigerischer, his pieces were much more of a longer process. He would walk the beach. He would pick up shells as a beachcomber. He would bring them back to the studio, photograph them. On his iPad, he would do a drawing from those shells. He would colorize them, and then he would put that back into the robot, mm-hmm. back into Midjourney, and tell it to create this in the style of the Japanese artist Murakami, mm-hmm. or Miro, or like a movement with trans-automatism. And it's amazing that the different things that it would produce. He would take that, and then he would put it through different iterations. And that was his process, and he had those printed for the show in a grid of 12. Mm. Whereas other artists were basically traditional artists that were using this as a way to play with different ideas,
right.
And different styles.
Right.
And I think one of the great benefits of it is that artists can use it to explore things they normally wouldn't, areas that they wouldn't normally go into.
Right.
Randy Travis, I think, is one of the best uses of AI because he's had a stroke and has not been able to sing for years. But he has new songs coming out in the next few weeks that he has created with AI. And they're recreating his voice. And he has new things coming out. And his family and his fans are just thrilled and enthralled about what's going on. And I think that's one of the great uses for AI going forward, even for visual artists, is that they will be able to continue to create even though they have physical disabilities and something has happened to them.
Now, your piece in the show was titled Demigods, an Anatomical Chart.
Yes.
Right? So tell us a little bit about it.
That piece was, it's a long process of producing that piece. It's a very large piece. It's like 24 by 60, 65 inches, maybe 70 inches, 72 inches. So it's life-size, and these two figures are life-size. And that came through my working with Midjourney for over a year and trying to get it to produce what I wanted. Midjourney itself had times when it was struggling to deal with all the issues that it was that the company itself was dealing with. There were artists coming in saying, "You're stealing my images, you're stealing my work." If you would use certain prompts, it would say, "You can't do that," and it would shut you down. It wouldn't produce an image with that prompt in there. There were other times when it became, when it started censoring things, and everything I would put in, it would turn into sort of a romance novel, except on the romance novel cover, the figures were fully clothed, and romance novels don't usually have those types of images, so they were censoring everything. And for Val, my partner, he was putting in things, and everything was coming out really saccharine and sweet, and it wasn't a beautiful, bold, abstract piece that it was presenting a couple of months ago. So the engineers that were working with the program, I think, were struggling to find a balance. And over that time, it was a struggle for us to continue to produce wonderful pieces, because I would put things in some days and it was like, how the hell did it come up with such an ugly thing? But over time, it got through those versions and got much better.
Yeah.
So that's how that happened. But it took a long time, and we had to take that final image and do some editing in Photoshop and other things, because the figures came out with four toes on 2 feet.
Yeah. Ooh.
So it was.
We're talking about AI and creativity, wondering what listeners think about using AI in the creative process. How is AI different from or similar to other technology when it comes to creating art? You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the role of AI in art. Would you think about a piece of art differently if you knew AI had been used in its creation? Should artists have to disclose what technology, including AI, they used in their creative process? You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us this morning is Molly de Moulinaire. Did I get that right? De Moulinaire. I got it. All right. executive director of the Cultural Center of Cape Cod, John Stringfellow, artist and one of the jurors for the autonomous exhibit. All right, Molly, another piece from the show listeners can see at our website, capeandislands.org, is called Confused. What can you tell us about the artist and this piece? It's a quilt, right?
Yes. Okay. And so this is an example of when you had asked how we kind of gave parameters to people of how they could utilize art, the AI and the art. So this person actually used a technology that more people are actually familiar with and more comfortable with, which is Photoshop, right? Which is still a type of AI. It's still helping you change an image. And so this particular quilt, again, a fiber artist, right? There's something, it's real, it's in front of you, you're touching it, it's very tactile. But they had taken a really striking image, and then they had kind of broken that up, sliced it into different pieces, and then she quilted it in that kind of jarring effect, so that the person's face is kind of coming off into different spaces. And so they used Photoshop, which has been around for a really long time and much more, accepted when you think of artificial intelligence in the art world. And she had two different pieces in the exhibition. It was fun to see all the different mediums of art that's as they were coming into the gallery as well, because it really, it was nice to see something, you know, it wasn't just what people think, oh, it's just you prompt and then you print something and how is that art, right?
Well, especially since you said there were no parameters, right? So it's like you don't know what you're going to get. Right. Yeah. And listeners, you can see some of the pieces we're discussing at capeandislands.org/thepoint. What are other pieces from the show that you want to highlight? And Molly, I'll ask you first and then you, John, so you get to think about it for a minute. Molly.
I think John Goldman's The Fuzzy Truth was really interesting for us. And so he utilized AI to help create a word, which was truth. And he has a whole truth series that he's been working on in a collection. But this particular one, if you think of, you know, a Sesame Street fuzzy character, almost like a Grover type character. So he created the letters out of, and they were all fuzzy. And then he actually made a physical representation of those. So in the gallery, there's this large, maybe 6 foot wide, orange, bright orange truth, but it's like a stuffed animal fuzziness. Mm. And so it's called The Fuzzy Truth. And the point of his truth series is sometimes it's hard to tell where truth is in our current life in the world. And so he's bringing to light that particular element of that. That was the message behind that piece, was The Fuzzy Truth.
Clever, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, John.
Leo and Mike by Betty Johnson?
Beth Johnston.
She created a piece that basically looked like a photograph taken in the studio of Leonardo and Michelangelo hugging each other like bros, you know, the bromance. And it was a fabulous piece, and it looked like something that, it was like a regular photo, but of these two historical characters. And her pieces varied in style from piece to piece, and that was one of the reasons that I gave her one of the top awards and a secondary award, is because she was using it to create totally different things that were unlike anything that she was creating in her regular studio work.
So how did artists describe or explain their use of AI?
They in their we asked for statements from them, and they would describe how they used it in their process. So with each piece of the exhibition, we had an explanation of how they used it in their work.
And did you use that explanation in your, you know, when you were as a juror, was that, that count?
As a juror and for the awards. For the awards especially, because there were statements made by some of the artists that helped me to feel that it was a lot more significant, because I could see what they did. And some of them talked about their disabilities and how AI had opened up new worlds for them, and they had sort of come unstuck creatively because the AI's help had allowed them to do things stylistically they never had done before. So
that must have been interesting to read all those, Molly.
It was. It really, and because so much of being an artist is the creativity in your head long before you touch the canvas, right? And people have so much, there's so much types of creativity, right? And I love, actually, when you talk about this interview, it is really about art and or AI and creativity, not necessarily art. And I think that's really important because the creativity starts long before whether you're going to take a picture. How are you framing that picture? What's that composition look like? If you're a dancer and you're trying to create movement, you're creating that in a space long before you actually take that first step. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's been great about AI. And the accessibility, I think, is a really important piece of it, right? Like sometimes people don't have the same abilities physically.
Right.
And so, you know, we're allowing people to paint, you know, through words and to put different marks on paper through prompts and opening up a whole new world to people that may not ever be able to pick up a paintbrush.
Yeah.
And that's really inspiring.
Right. Yeah. I'm just thinking that, as you say, opening up that whole creative process to somebody who would not have that otherwise.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
So what kind of response did you get from visitors about the show and the work?
The response we got in the gallery was really, really positive. A gentleman had come to one of our gallery dinners and he said he hadn't been this inspired by art in 20 years.
Wow.
And I think a lot of that is because they didn't have any expectations when they walked in, or they walked in thinking, I'm not sure I'm going to like this, but I'm going to go see it. And that's what I love about mounting exhibitions at the Cultural Center is getting people to come in with maybe their own ideas and then learning something and they leave completely different than when they walked in. Our brains are so trained to prove ourselves correct, right? Like it is the strongest brain function in humans is to make sure that what you're thinking is absolutely what's happening. And so I think art is such a powerful tool for change in that way, right? Because people can come in and learn about subjects that they've never even necessarily had an interest in. And then it sparks conversation. And also the multi-generational conversations that happen in the gallery, right? We've got an older population in our Bass River location, right? And so you've got 80-year-olds coming in with their grandchildren. And they're having conversations, you know, and sometimes the kids, you know, they're 8 and they're like, oh, yeah, like,
of course,
we do this, you know, and it's not a big deal. Yeah. And so I love those conversations, too, because it's like this, you have this real bonding moment between people when they're learning things together. And learning by trial and error, we had a station where people could try to do it themselves, right? So they could learn to start making prompts into the computer and see what they were getting out of it. And so just that interactivity in the galleries with the people, it was really, really special. And I think it was based on our initial feedback we got when we put out the call, which was a little intense.
Yeah. You were a little worried.
I was a little worried. Yeah. And you know, when you're putting things on walls, you're always taking a risk, right?
Right.
And as a museum person, like we want to take people on journeys. We want to take people to places that they may not have been. And this really allowed us to do that. It was a real joy to watch people interact with the work.
Yeah. We're talking about AI and creativity. We'd love to know what you think. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We think of AI as potentially forever changing art and creativity, but there was a time when the new technology was photography and people thought it would destroy painting. We've been here before, so talk about the history of the intersection of creativity and technology, Molly.
Right. So history repeats itself over and over.
Over and over, right.
And you're right. I mean, really, people did think that the camera was going to destroy painting, because if you can take a picture of something that is realistic, why would you ever have to paint that again? And now we know, of course, that has really changed. And now painters use photography to help them capture a moment in time that then they can carry forward and be inspired by and go back to their studio and paint where the environment is not then changing. So I think we're constantly experiencing disruptors, right? If you think of autonomous vehicles, right, that's it's a huge disruptor. And it's very much that same idea of people kind of being scared of it and not knowing. Oh, and they think their car's just going to take off with them, right? But it's actually bringing a lot of safety benefits to us, right? All these new features in cars. And so I think really, for me, what that the importance of that intersection is to explore. And the cat's already out of the bag, right? Artists and AI artisans didn't create AI, right? They're utilizing a tool that has been open to all different industries. I know, you know, when you talk to writers, what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there could be an argument like, well, would AI replace interviews, right? And there's a human, no, because there's a human element, and it's almost the element of imperfection,
right?
There's a sterility to things that are created over and over and over. And, you know, you've seen this in design programs, right? So you've got graphic designers, and then all of a sudden Canva comes to the world, and everybody can now create a perfect little designed Facebook post, right? But it is very formulaic. And so it's not really, you can see that they're utilizing a program that's helping them kind of get to that point. And I think it's the human imperfection. It's the human heartbeat that makes you stop and think and have a bit of a moment that's never going to go away. It's never, ever going to go away. And it's one of the things that makes the United States so competitive in the market is our creativity. And that's because it's not starting with technology. We're just using technology as a tool to enhance that.
Yeah. Anything you want to add to that, John? She pretty much did a good job, didn't she? Explain that.
I think that if people can see that it is just, it's another tool.
Yeah.
And it can help you in your thinking, in your ideation. It can help you in your process. And if you fold it into your process, I think it makes you stronger as an artist and as a being. And that's how I use it.
All right. Let's talk to Lindsay, who's calling from New Bedford. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good.
I was very excited about Molly's comments about AI as a tool. My organization is DATMA. We're in New Bedford, and we are currently in the process of producing a piece using AI. So this conversation is really resonating with us right now. We have this artist that we're creating a sculpture for that will debut in 2025. And her name is Mona Gandhi. She's an Iranian living in Washington, but she's a trained architect and creating this lovely sculpture for us that, you know, you can walk through and around. But what was so captivating about why we wanted to produce her artwork is because she's using AI to have this skin over the sculpture that will change color based on the mood of the person walking in and around the sculpture.
Wow.
And the beautiful part about that is that, like, you know, we're communicating in this way where it's beyond words, but there's like visual language of color. Yeah. And almost like having a collective conversation about emotion as something that we keep inside, but AI is allowing us to have this conversation in public and being more comfortable with like how we're feeling and, you know, getting out of our headspace, which we're still working on getting out of after the past few years. But I totally agree that it is a tool. It is having us face conversations about disclosure of AI that will be certainly included in the didactics and but also a really great learning experience and ways that we can talk about continuing to push the use of AI in this other way rather than just like tracking a person and their age, but just having different kinds of conversation and creating a beauty in it.
Yeah, Lindsay, sounds so cool. I can't wait to see it.
Cool. I know.
Yeah, thank you.
The exhibition that you guys have on display sounds cool too, and I can't wait for this weekend to run down and see it. So thanks for bringing this topic up. It's very important.
We should say it's over, right? You can't run down and see it,
but
you can see photos.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I still haven't had my coffee yet. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. You can see it also
right away
at a page on my site, which is capecodstar.com/AI.
Yeah,
and we'll see that, and there are more things that
right. And we'll have a link you can check the photos out, but you can't actually come see it because it's over.
I know.
All right, but Lindsay, thanks for the phone call. Richard is giving us a call from Oak Bluffs. Hi, Richard.
Hi, newly minted grandfather here. I have a little bit of a dissenting opinion. I hear this sort of rapture about AI and that MOOC sculpture in New Bedford sounds great. I think that's fantastic, but I think as I've seen AI presented in media, let's say PBS News or whatever, I see these sort of bells and whistles presentations of very loud graphics moving around and whatever. I think the general effect of AI is going to be used as something as a distraction. And I think more and more people, it's going to actually marginalize the arts, because what we're learning to do with all the media coming at us is basically to shut down imagery. And I think if we're going to have more and more stuff trying to distract us, we're going to be more and more rejecting that imagery. I'm talking about in the general sense. But I do think AI can be used. For instance, that sculpture sounds great. And I, as an artist, have always played around with originality and then how you can alter that originality. For instance, I have a John Lewis picture with a backlit lighting behind it, and the public could play with that lighting, so they could make it, and it really made the image stand out, and I made the painting to be backlit. And I think that you could take, I'll give that's one little thought. Let's say I ran the Louvre, and they're now putting the Mona Lisa in some kind of basement special room right now. And if you had, I think, okay, and you took a camera, and people could go up to the camera, and had the, there's the Mona Lisa, there you have a image the same size of a screen, and people could look into the camera, and whatever expression they had would go into that screen and be the expression on Mona Lisa. And I think that what we need now in the art isn't so much more bells and whistles and ways of distilling this and whatever. I think we need more, what you're talking about, that sculpture, we need more interaction with originality and artificial, that interaction, because people, it's so passive going to a museum.
Richard, thank you. I want to let Molly respond to that. Thank you, Richard, for sharing your thoughts. Go ahead, Molly.
Yeah, and I think those are really good points, Richard. And I think that kind of this edutainment that you're speaking of when you go into museums and amusement parks and kind of the flash and trash, you might call it, right? I do think that there is that ability to distract people, and there is this oversaturation of big, bold things that people then tune out. But I also think it might bring us back and say, okay, now we have a much larger appreciation for traditional art and the artistry that goes behind it, right? So I think if things a lot of times run in cycles, and so I think that we will see that. But utilizing it as an interactive tool is absolutely such an incredible way to go, right? And so, but it requires computer technology and coding and artificial intelligence to make that interaction happen, right? And so I think what we have to try not to do is put A and I in a box of this is what it is. How do we use it to create incredible experiences for people? And I love that idea.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. What do you think about AI and creativity? 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about AI and creativity this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us this morning is Molly DeMoulinier. She's the Executive Director of the Cultural Center of Cape Cod, and John Stringfellow, artist and one of the jurors for the autonomous exhibit. All right, so Molly, what are the ethical implications of people, be they visual artists, authors, musicians, whoever, using AI? It's different, right, when we're talking about art versus maybe something else?
It is different depending on what you're talking about, right? Drawing inspiration from something is not stealing something,
right?
People draw inspiration from the masters all the time, right? And often as a MFA student, you're recreating those masters, right? Because you're learning those techniques, being inspired by your environment. You're not stealing something. You're being inspired by it, right? And so I think that's a really important thing to look at. Now, writing is very different, right? You can put in a prompt to write a poem in the style of Mary Oliver, and people who teach poetry and who write poetry can immediately tell mm-hmm. that it's generated by AI. Because again, there's not this, there's not a humanity to it. It's formulaic. It's pulling, computers know zeros and ones, right? Mm-hmm. So it's pulling together a lot of different information. It's also pulling together other influences that are written about the artist, the poet, the musician. And so it's not also pulling a pure example of that particular artist, because it's pulling all the different things that I've already said about that artist. And you mentioned the musician, and also the Beatles just released, right?
I was thinking
the
that
newest song.
That, yeah.
And I mean, that's kind of amazing that, you know, we're not going to lose this piece of music that was already in process when John Lennon passed away. And so I think ethics are always hard to keep up with when we're talking about disruptive technologies, mm-hmm. right? When you think of 3D printing, you know, they're learning how to 3D print organs, mm-hmm. right? And there's ethics behind that. And science is always pushing those boundaries. And so it's those intersections, again, of where science and art meet and creativity explodes out. Yes, there, you know, we want to make sure that artists' work is protected. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult.
What about not disclosing the use of AI? How would you respond to an artist who says they don't disclose the process and tools they use? So why would AI be any different?
You have to give them a point, right? If something is completely created by AI, I do think that it should be disclosed. You know, if you're just going in there and you're putting in some prompts and you're not manipulating it, you're not touching it, you're not humanizing it in any way, then I think it should be disclosed.
Yeah.
But there wasn't anything in the exhibition that was simply just put in as a prompt. And I think that that's really common. And so, just like you don't say, I was inspired by the Van Gogh and then I painted this, you know, mm-hmm. you're not disclosing your muse necessarily. I mean, sometimes you are because it's fun, but for the most part, people aren't describing their muse.
Right.
And so I think unless they're really just spitting out something that the computer has created, I don't think it's necessary to disclose.
What do you think, John?
I disagree to a certain extent.
Come closer to you, Mike. Yeah.
This is part of what Molly and I... not argued about, but disagreed about, and it was a healthy argument in the exhibition, and how do we deal with this? Because there were pieces that were straight out of the machine, out of the robot that I made, that were dependent on the styles of artist, and I used three prompts. But anyone that knows art will know that these three things don't belong together, because I would put in the style of Leyendecker, Musha, and Tom of Finland. And those three artists don't belong together. So when you mash those up, you get a completely new creation. And part of the creativity there to me is that from my strange mind, from my strange artist mind, I put those things together to achieve a certain look. Has anyone else done that? Now, they can, you know, 50,000 people today can go out and put those same prompts in and maybe achieve a similar effect. But part of it is still the human brain creating these things. And I have a friend that is a doctor of internal medicine in California. He is not an artist in any way. And the thing that he is doing at this point is in his free time, he's creating the same program that I'm working with in Midjourney, one of the other programs. And he is just putting in, he has a great creative brain. And he's funny, and he's making his version of a Jewish Star Wars series. And it's absolutely hilarious. And he uses this to recreate in his time off. So there's a lot of ways that people can use it that maybe are not artists. And I think that some of these people will actually create things that will end up in museums, even though they weren't technically artists. So I think that... that's one of the other uses. That's one of the other things that we deal with. I do think it's a problem for someone not disclosing it. And I do think they need to disclose it. And I have no problem with that when it is disclosed.
So, John, what are some other ways AI is being used in the creative sphere that has caught your attention?
Well, the way that it was a program this week with Randy Travis, and the fact that... that just blew me away that people that musicians would use that in that way. I see that other artists that are that can still somehow communicate will be able to create pieces. And AI is another, there's another step to this, is that there are now painting and drawing machines. Mm-hmm. So at some point, that will be the next step. It's programmed into the machine, and then it will be executed by the machine on the other side. But there's still an artist in control of things there, directing it. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's it's the human brain is still creating these things. So that's part of that push and pull of, did the robot do it or did I have any say in it? Yeah. So,
Go ahead, Molly.
No, I was just thinking about, you know, painting robots. I think, you know, it's going to, I do believe that a person would look at it and be able to tell that a human didn't touch it. The layering and the complexities that would happen, I don't think that would really be there. And I think it would look very much like a paint by number type of mm-hmm. situation, right? Or like a three, you know, when you 3D print something, you have the different layers. But I think that you would definitely, those hand strokes by artists can never be replaced.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, some of those, as you mentioned, where they recreate famous works of art, yeah. right? And yeah. they do, I mean, they do take into consideration the brush strokes mm. there. Mm-hmm. I mean, they look, I mean, I'm not an art expert, so I don't know. To me, they look like the real thing, right? Yep. Obviously, somebody who really knows art is going to know the difference, right? But I don't know. Should there be different standards for the use of AI in different art forms? You know, for example, prose, music, visual arts. Should the standards be the same or different? What do you think?
Oh, I'm not an intellectual property attorney, Mindy. I mean, and that's what it's really about. It's, you know, we want to protect people's intellectual property and their creativity. So I don't think I can really have
okay.
a great opinion
yeah.
about that. But I think, you know, yeah. it's...
So going back to Donna Mohan's piece titled An Eye on You Three, mm-hmm. she relied on getting accurate data from AI for the images of the eye. Mm-hmm. But the data that comes out is only as good as the data that goes in, right? Mm-hmm. So talk about some of the pitfalls of using AI. If you're not, you might not be getting the right data.
And that's where, when people utilize it for writing, you know, if you tell ChatGPT to write an article about Picasso, mm-hmm. it's going to write an article, but you're not going to know if that article is accurate, right? So the fact checking, you would have to fact check that article and edit that article just like you would in a human article, right? Because just because it's put it in there doesn't mean that you know that it's accurate. And so I think that's a big pitfall. I think it's interestingly enough, as smart, quote unquote, as we say that computers are, it really does not do a good job in the in anatomy, right? He was saying about the feet, the two toes on two feet, yeah. right? And that's true. I mean, you really rarely get a great hand out of AI. It's so interesting. And obviously it has billions of images of hands. So what is that, right? Like, why is that happening? And so I think those are some of the pitfalls, is accuracy, garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
Right. And then even though it has almost unlimited resources, it doesn't seem to actually be able to capitalize on that and give you really accurate anatomy.
You had a great explanation of, like, you talked about teaching kids coding.
Yeah.
Tell that story, because it makes so much sense.
Yeah. So when we teach, like, itty bitty kids, right? I'm talking about preschool and at kindergarten, when you teach kids how computer coding works, you do it as a human, you know, say, okay, I'm a computer, tell me what to do. And a kid will be like, go forward. And I'll start walking forward and I'll just hit the wall on the other side of the room. They're like, well, why didn't you stop? I said, well, you didn't tell me to stop. Right. And so literally, to teach coding to a kid, you have to, or to really anyone, including a computer, you have to say, OK, start with your left foot. Take one step forward. Stop. Take 1/8 of a turn to the right. Stop. Put your right foot forward. Stop. Right. This is how computers think. They are not intelligent beings. You can't just tell a computer walk around the room.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lego robotics are great at that, right? Like you can really get into it with kids and teach them those principles. But I think that's why AI is limited as well, is because it is not a creative being. It is not a person. We're not losing that creativity in people. Yeah. We're just using it as a tool.
John, what are other issues that we should consider as AI moves further into the creative process?
Well, one of the things, going back to what you were just talking about, garbage in, garbage out. Mm-hmm. There can be a bias. There can be a racial bias. There can be prejudice. There can be economic biases in terms of like the large language models that these programs are built on. And that's part of the problem, that it has to be fair. It has to be, if it's going to be universal, everyone needs to be able to go in and to type in the type of image that they want to work with. And it has to be able to understand those things. And there's artists that the system still does not understand. It doesn't know that they exist. Mm-hmm. One of the, this is off subject, but one of the main ways to teach the robot is that we actually would put some of our own artwork in and use that as a takeoff point, as a origin point to create things out of, and do it our work, my piece, in the style of Miro or Picasso, like Blue Period, mm-hmm. that type of thing.
So you have to pick which period when you're doing.
You have to be
Picasso.
Very careful. Yes, exactly. Which Picasso?
Yeah, which one? Right.
So that's one of the things that you have to do, is you have to be very precise in how you, what you say. The directions that you give the robot, you do have to be very careful, and you have to learn how to work with it and how to prompt it.
Yeah. So. It's so interesting, too, and as you look at this technology, I have a daughter who's a very gifted artist. I mean, her drawing since she was little, and painting, and she just does it naturally. But she got, and when she was in high school, she started doing the digital art. Mm-hmm. And I was like, digital art? What? But I'm amazed at the things she can create on the computer. So she's just using a different medium, right? But yeah. She is creating.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, Hockney did a beautiful series of Spring in Normandy. And all of the pieces in the exhibition, which hung at major institutions, the Royal Gallery being one of them in London, and he created all of these different images on his iPad, all through a tool called Procreate. Mm. And some people would say, well, then is it real art? Mm-hmm. Now Hockney can get away with it, right? Because he's amazing, and he has the trust of the people and the institutions that presented the work. We know that those institutions aren't just printing off a whole bunch of canvas, right?
Right.
These are one-time pieces that were printed to be in museums. But I think that is also a disruptive technology. This idea of Procreate, all the brushes, all the colors, all the layers, right? As an artist, when you're doing work on canvas, you can't delete a layer. Mm. Right? Right? So that's amazing.
It was less than a minute, but you have a really interesting show currently up at the Cultural Center. So tell us about that.
Absolutely. It's called One Earth, and it is really incredible. It's three artists: Sarah Thornington, who's an artist and art activist here on Cape Cod, Aaron Starr from Rhode Island, is in our Blue Gallery, and Scooby Lepowski, is from Cambridge, and he is a sound installation artist. And so you can actually come to the Cultural Center right now, and you can listen to our Japanese maple tree on our patio make music.
Ooh.
He takes the electrical current of the tree, assigns instrumentation to the different frequencies. You can also hear it at Hidden Life Radio. So right now you can log on and listen to the Japanese maple tree at the Cultural Center of Cape Cod.
Wow. We'll post a link with more information about the Cultural Center of Cape Cod at our website, capeandislands.org. Molly DeMulinaire, Executive Director of the Cultural Center of Cape Cod, and John Stringfellow, artist. Thanks so much for being with us. Interesting hour. Thanks for
Thank you so
Thank
much,
you very
Mindy.
Much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.